So our next speaker, changing directions, is Professor Chris Weeb from University of Winnipeg and University of Manitoba, talking about material synthesis and materials discovery.
Okay, thanks, Bruce. I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me and putting together such a nice series of talks for this workshop. It's also great to see a lot of people attending this workshop and visiting McMaster and Waterloo. So McMaster's alma mater, I got my master's degree with Bruce and my PhD with John Greeden. And my career has sort of been on the interface between chemistry and physics. And the reason why is I wanted to learn about growing samples. And what I can tell you after all the years of growing samples is that it's as much of an art as it is a science. And so I'm going to try and stick to the science in this talk, tell you how we make frustrated materials. And I've broken up my talk into three sections. So I'll briefly mention lattice types that are targets for solid-state synthesis. And then I'll talk about methods, and then finally I'll mention crystal growth. So some of you may have already been to the workshop on crystal growth, but some of you haven't. So since that's a huge part of synthesis, I want to mention how we grow crystals. And I'll probably focus mostly on image furnace growth, see how much time I have to focus on our techniques. Okay, so I promise there's no Hamiltonians in this talk whatsoever. Okay, so first of all, there's a nice introduction to frustration already in the talk you already saw, but just to briefly review, so there's lots of ways you can define frustration, but one of the ways is to one way to define it is through the inability of spins to satisfy their local constraints, right? So if the lattice is the culprit, we call that geometric frustration. And for antiferromagnetic spins coupled on a triangular unit at low temperatures, you might expect an up-down, up-down state, but it can achieve that sort of nail state for an icing-like system. So this last spin here is known to be frustrated. And the name of the game of frustration is degeneracy, right? So since the system can't find a long-range ordered nail state, some sort of energetic compromise that forms at low temperatures. And that's where all the interesting physics comes about, all these exotic magnetic states. In three dimensions, you can think about connecting triangles into tetrahedra, and in principle, at least two of those spins in those tetrahedra should be frustrated. So over the years, solid-state chemists and kinetic magnetic physicists have looked for lots of model systems to try to study frustration in more detail. And some common ones in two dimensions include the triangular lattice and Kagome lattice that I'll discuss in some detail. And in three dimensions, there's a phase center cubic and some power chlor. But there also are some other lattices that have appeared over the last few years. So I want to mention some other model compounds throughout this talk. Okay, so as I mentioned, the name of the game of frustration is degeneracy. So you can imagine that if you can't order all these spins to an up-down sort of near state of interaction, then you can have, in principle, six states that they're degenerate. They'll have exactly the same energy. And when degeneracy persists in these frustrated systems, you tend to see enhancement of spin fluctuations and a suppression of magnetic ordering, right? So there's an empirical parameter that Ramirez used called the frustration index that was alluded to in the last talk as well, which is a ratio of the absolute value of your Curie of ice temperature divided by your nail temperature, right? So a system wants to order on a temperature scale roughly on the order of the Curie of ice temperature, but it can't because it's frustrated, right? So one of the ways of sort of identifying frustrated systems is through this parameter Ramirez introduced, and a frustration index of roughly around 10 or so is a highly frustrated system. So keep that in mind throughout some of these systems that you'll see throughout this talk. Okay, so there's lots of inspiration for solid-state chemists to try to look for ways you can connect triangles. So in two dimensions, you might imagine Kagome lattices is actually named after a type of Japanese basket weaving. We see this a lot in art, this sort of same motif is repeated over and over again. And if you look throughout our world, you'll see lots of different ways you connect triangles. So in principle, there's many types of topologies you can explore with frustrated lattices. I want to focus on which ones are important for kinetic matter physics, and particularly which ones that theorists want to spend a lot of time modeling, and then we can test ideas in frustration. Okay, so I've broken up sort of my systems into three types. So frustration in one dimension. So usually we don't talk about frustration in 1D. Magnetic systems shouldn't order if they're purely one-dimensional. But if you have alternating antiferromagnetic ferromagnetic exchange on spin change, then in principle, system is even more frustrated than it is naturally, right? So that's an example of frustration in one dimension. I'll sort of briefly mention some of these systems, and then I'll go on and talk about these systems in two dimensions and three dimensions, and then how we try to synthesize them. Okay, so this is an example of a frustrated system in one dimension. So this is actually lead vanadium oxide, so it's material that my group's been working on for the last few years. So in this material, you have two types of vanadium ions. So the blue is a vanadium 4+, which has one d electron, and vanadium 5+ is non-magnetic in green. And in this system, there are these nice sort of chains of these blue octahedra that are connected through these red oxygens here. And actually, in the system, if you look at the spin interaction, there's an alternating antiferromagnetic-ferromagnetic exchange at low temperatures. So we've measured the accessibility in this compound. You find there's no sharp cusp. All you see is sort of a broad feature in accessibility, indicative of some sort of short-range ordering and strong 2D correlations in this compound. So in zero field, the compound doesn't order as far as we can tell. And why is this interesting? Well, if you apply a field to this, if you have a singlet, what happens at low temperature in this compound is that there's actually, you actually get these magnetic paired spins at low temperatures that form these little singlets. And at low temperatures, you can have, a singlet triplet transition. And this triplet transition can be split by a magnetic field, right? So if you apply a magnetic field, you'll have energy that basically is does not change at all. And these two here will change in a linear fashion until it starts to cross near zero energy at some critical field, right? So why are these systems interesting? Well, there's a lot of work being done right now on Bose-Einstein condensates. So in principle, these are triplets, so they're bosons, and it essentially costs zero energy to create them when you're at these critical fields. So you have enormous number of excitations they can create for free, essentially. And they can condense into what's called the Bose-Einstein condensate of magnons. So we recently did some work at the Magnet Lab on these compounds. We grew single crystals, and I'll talk about how we grew the crystals a little later. But just to give you some of the background science, we believe that actually above this relatively low field of around 5 tesla, it forms this magnon BEC. And then we worked with Marcello Jaime at the Magnet Lab in Los Alamos, looked at this in high fields. And right now we're trying to trace out what the power law dependence is as high fields as well to see if it really follows this BEC model. Okay, so that's an example of frustration in one dimension. That would be some interesting physics. Now, in two dimensions, we have a lot more choices, right? In two dimensions, there's all sorts of ways you can connect triangles together. So there's the triangular lattice or the honeycomb lattice. The honeycomb lattice, in principle, is a brush drape for just nearest neighbor antiferromagnetic exchange. You can have this congomy lattice, or you can have this Bethe lattice. There's all sorts of different types of lattices you can think of in two dimensions. But actually, theorists have given some very precise targets, if you like, for solid state synthesis. And it goes back to even the work of Anderson, right? So Anderson said that the triangular lattice should be tried out for what's called a resonating valence bond state. So one of the targets of solid-state chemists for a long time is trying to synthesize a perfect triangular lattice, right? And nature doesn't like these thruster states. Nature likes to follow the third law of thermodynamics, so these systems tend to order as you get down to low temperatures. So nature tends to distort these away from their ideal, if you like, triangular connectivities and create distortions, right? So there's been a lot of work by solid-state chemists trying to come up with ideal hexagonal lattices. And there's also been a lot of work recently on ideal Kagome lattices. There's also predictions for quantum spin liquids that you'll see later on today. And I'll mention these systems as well and what efforts solid state chemists have been spending to make these compounds. Okay, so what's an RVB state? Well, it's a resonating valence bond state. So it's sort of analogous to what chemists see in benzene, where you have a resonating valence bond of electrons that are moving around. In the case on a hexagonal lattice, there was a prediction by Anderson that you should have what's called the valence bond liquid or resonating valence bond state. So there's different types of ordering that electrons can attempt at low temperatures in these quantum spin systems. You can have what's called a valence bond solid, where all the spins pair up into these nice singlets in a sort of a static state. If you have an enhancement of quantum fluctuations, you can get this liquid state where you have these singlets that are sort of fluctuating as a function of time. So you took snapshots of those lattice different points in time, you would find there'd be different singlets. Singlets would actually move around the lattice. So this is one of the reasons why solid-state chemists spent a long time trying to look for these triangular lattices or perfect triangular lattices, because this is sort of one of the holy grails of kinetic matter physics, finding the ideal valence bond liquid. So there's a nice review article by Leon Balance in Nature that you take a look at if you want to see how we define spin liquids, and there's a talk later on today, so I won't spend too much time talking about spin liquids, but I will mention that one of the same changes of a spin liquid is in the excitations, right? There's an exotic excitation called a spin-on, and that actually leads to a thermodynamic signature in the specific heat that I'll talk about a little bit later. Okay, so as I mentioned, Mother Nature doesn't like these states, so nail states usually win. And for Heisenberg-like spins on triangular plaquettes, you usually get this 120 degree order. But nonetheless, recently there have been a lot of examples of spin liquids. Spin liquid states have been found in two-dimensional systems, right? So actually Patrick Lee recently was quoted in Science, "This is the end to the drought of quantum spin liquids." Salt and chemists have come up with these things sort of all over the place. So there are these nice organic systems, organic salts that have these copper triangular lattices. There are these other compounds here which are based on minerals, like this one here, which is based on Herbert Smithite. And I'll talk about how we synthesize it a little bit later. And recently there's been work on spin liquids in diamond lattices and hyperkagome, which is actually sort of a three-dimensional twisting of kagome lattice. So usually nail states win, but chemists are getting smarter, kinetic physicists are getting smarter and thinking of more and more exotic systems we can use to test these ideas. Okay, so before we go on to three dimensions, as I mentioned, the Kagome lattice, I mentioned on the last slide. So it's a different lattice topology than the hexagonal lattice, but it's also predicted to be a topology you expect a quantum spin liquid to live in, and you'll probably see more about that later today, as I mentioned. And what's sort of curious about this, the chemists have spent years and years and years trying to make these perfect Kagome systems, and Mother Nature has already provided a lot of them for us already, right? So actually, a lot of the best systems are these mineral systems. The mineral systems that are created naturally have a lot of disorder, but chemists have spent a lot of time trying to figure out how to fool Mother Nature a little bit and how to get rid of that disorder. But a lot of the best candidates for these are all based on natural minerals, and there are hydrothermal methods that are used to grow these crystals that I'll talk about later. Okay, so before we go on to 3D, I just want to mention a type of lattice that's not that focused on very much in terms of frustration. When you just think about connecting triangles together, you can also connect squares together to give you a square lattice, and the principle of square lattice can be frustrated, right? So imagine if you create a square lattice with a J1 and J2, so J1 is your nearest neighbor exchange, J2 is your next nearest neighbor exchange. If you have antiferromagnetic nearest neighbor exchange, antiferromagnetic next nearest neighbor exchange, in principle, you shouldn't get this nail state, right? Because you're violating this J2 constraint here, right? So so systems that have those types of interactions are also in principle frustrated, and that's where physics is relevant to a physics of cuprates and related compounds. Fortunately, in the cuprates, lanthanum copper oxide, nail state persists, but in our systems, it doesn't, right? So there's alternating exchange that can be important. Okay, so I'll move on to three-dimensional systems, and I'll talk about how we make these, give you a bit more background. So most of you have probably seen the particle lattice before, and I was mentioned in the last talk as being the host lattice for spin ices. So pyrochlor is actually a type of mineral. It's based on the chemical formula A2B2O7. And actually, what's interesting about these is that they form two interplanetary networks of tetrahedra. So it doesn't matter if you occupy the A sites of ions or the B sites of ions, you'll still get a frustrated sublattice of these coordinate shared tetrahedra. Now, typically, the A site is trivalent and the B site is tetravalent, but you can fill out the chemistry a little bit to give you different oxidation states in there. But that usually works out to give you your -14 for your oxygen. And there's an enormous variety of ground states, right? So you look at the periodic table. This graph here is showing you the green is where you can have A site substitutions, and the blue here is where you can have B site substitutions. There's an enormous amount of variety for these particle lattices. It's very, very robust cubic lattice. Theorists like cubic things, right? It's easier to model than our systems. And there's a wide variety of exotic states. There's too many to mention in this talk here. But you can see this great review article that was produced recently by GGG, and so it's in Review of Modern Physics in 2010. I will mention something about spin ices a little bit later when I talk about new spin ices that we're working on. So one of the things that chemists do when they're looking for new materials is we look at what's called stability field curves or stability fields. So this is actually a graph which is showing you inside this line here are all the stable states that you have for your radius of your A ion, your radius of your B ion in your state here. And you notice that it's roughly proportional to each other, right? So you have to have, and your A site is basically the framing for your lattice, and your B site can be filled in with smaller ions. And this sort of shows us what's actually possible for lots of different substitutions, right? And since pyrochlores are naturally occurring minerals, they're very stable. You can try many different types of growths. You can try flux growths, for example. You can try hydrothermal growths. That's probably how this crystal is grown at the Canadian continent. It's actually a pyrochlore taken from Quebec. There are all sorts of different types of variations you can have. And since the pyrochlore lattice is so thermodynamically stable, you can also try high pressure growths, and I'll talk about some of these a little bit later. So down here, you can actually create the smaller pyrochlore lattices under high pressure. Okay, but A site isn't, in general, at ambient pressure, if the A site isn't large enough, you'll get a distortion, right? You'll distort what's called the fluorite structure, or you'll get a distorted monoclinic lattice in the end. Okay, so this is another common type of three-dimensional lattice. This is the spinel lattice. So spinels have a general formula of AB2O4. And this is showing you actually the coordination of oxygen, right? So don't get these two mixed up. This is the coordination of magnetic ions. This is the coordination of oxygen. So you can see the AO4 tetrahedra are in blue, and the BO6 octahedra are in red in here, right? And if you look at the B ions, how they're connected here, if you squint this picture, you might be able to see a little bit. If you look at how the B ions are connected here, it actually forms a network of coordinate tetrahedra, just like the pyrochlore lattice. So there's been a lot of work on spinels recently because they have the same lattice topology as pyrochlores if you look at what's going on the B site. Okay, so one of the last ones I want to talk about before I talk about methods is the FCC lattice. So the face there, cubic lattice, may seem sort of innocent, might not be, you might think of it as a frustrated lattice, but actually it forms a network of edge-shared tetrahedra. right? So there's lots of these that have been looked at recently in the literature. One of the ways you can create ordered FCC lattices is through the perovskites, right? So the perovskites have, my chalk went. So perovskites have the general form of ABO3. The dull perovskites have A2BB'O6. So in these dull perovskites, what they're doing is they're putting a non-magnetic ion on the A site, and they're putting magnetic ions on the B sites, right? And both of these will form, both of the B and B prime will form a face-centered cubic lattice, but usually you want just one of these lattices to look at when we're trying to model these systems. So what you want to do usually is find one magnetic ion on either the B or B prime. So there's a problem of disorder in a lot of these systems, right? That you can have different types of ions in these lattices. You have to make sure that the ions don't have different sizes, or sure they don't have the same sizes, right? You have to make sure they have different sizes and different charge ratios in order to give you an ordered BB prime site. So here's actually an example from literature. This is lanthanum lithium molybdenum oxide. So it's an exotic type of spin glass. It's actually not cubic, as a torsion cube, I believe it was monoclinic in this case here, but it actually forms, so the lanthanum is non-magnetic, the lithium is non-magnetic, molybdenum is molybdenum 5+. So these are the, this is actually a spin 1/2 molybdenum that you're putting on the molybdenum sites. And you can see the charges work out. So you have lithium. Lithium is a lot smaller than molybdenum, and lithium is +1 and molybdenum is +5. So that difference in size, the difference in charge is one of the reasons why you get this nice order of lattice as far as we can tell. Okay. So now we've got lights on basic glasses. Let's talk about synthesis. How do we make a lot of these compounds? Well, it's this sort of heat and beam method that's common among many solid state chemists. So you mix together stoichiometric ratios of where you're trying to react together. You press them into pellets to improve the kinetics. So you want those particles close together when you make those pellets. And then you heat it at high temperatures, either in air or in a variety of environments, depending if you want to reduce or oxidize your samples. And so typically, you know, solid state chemists will be very familiar with these mortar and pestles and putting different types of crucibles to do these types of reactions. And it might seem as a sort of a simple method. For reactions that are stable in air, this is pretty simple, but you always have to worry about things like oxygen stoichiometry. You have to worry about competing phases that can form. We often don't know the phase diagrams of these compounds at high temperatures. It can be very complex looking at the chemistry of these things, and you're often sort of working blind when you're first trying to do these reactions. So over the years, there have been lots of other methods that have become popular other than this heat and beam method. So there's intercalation techniques and high pressure techniques in sol gel, and I'll try and touch on these a little bit in the next few slides. Okay, so intercalation methods, right? So this is a way you can actually change the oxidation states if you like on your lattice, or you can change the carriers if you like for metal or an insulator by introducing other ions into the lattice. So this is a case where we're actually intercalating lithium Mn2O4, so it's a spinel compound, the manganese is magnetic, and we can actually put extra lithium into the other sites of the spinel, and you can convert it to Li2Mn2O4. Right, so how do you do that? Well, it's done by these Shimmy-Deuce methods that I worked on with a master many moons ago with John Greeden. So you can react this with N-butyl lithium, and you do this actually in a glove box at 40 degrees Celsius in a dried hexane solution with an argon environment, right? Because lithium butyl is extremely, extremely reactive. But if you do this carefully, and if you wash the sample many times, and if you do this reaction many, many times until basically you don't see anything reacting anymore, and you have the right lattice constant, you could get a fully lithiated lattice. And this compound in particular was interesting. If you look at the chemistry a little bit and think about the oxidation states, what are we changing here? We're changing the manganese oxidation state. So it was 3+ and 4+ for lithium Mn2O4, but now we're changing it to Mn3+ for lithium 2Mn2O4. And when you do that, actually, what we find is that there is no long-range ordering in this compound, the original compound is ordering. And what we do find is that there is ordering within these Kagome layers that are inherent in the pyrochlore lattice. So I introduced this example for another reason to show you that there's actually, if you look at the pyrochlore lattice along the 101 direction, you get these nice Kagome layers. And it turns out in this compound, it appears there's only two-dimensional ordering within these Kagome layers. Okay, so one technique that's become very popular lately is using high pressures to get different frustrated compounds. So this is actually a sequence of materials that we looked at recently with my postdoc, Haidong Zhao, who's now at University of Tennessee, Knoxville. And we're looking at barium-3 nickel antimony-209. So you probably noticed that this is actually a perovskite-related compound, but it's hexagonal perovskite, so-called 6H perovskites. You multiply this by a factor of 3, the ABO3, you can get this A3B3O9 phases. So if you make this compound, if you mix stoichiometric quantities of barium carbonate, nickel oxide, antimony oxide, you get this nice triangular lattice where all the nickel ions, which are spin one, that lie on top of each other, and they have this exchange between the layers here through these double antimony systems. And this system ends up ordering, it orders at roughly 13 Kelvin. If you do this reaction under pressure, if you're just under 3 gigapascals of pressure, you can actually distort the layers a little bit. So you actually distort an exchange as well between these two layers, and the antimony connectivity is different between the layers here. And this compound doesn't order, I believe it's a spin liquid can at low temperature. So the connectivity between the layers matters. When you're always making these compounds, you have to think about exchange. Think about how the different magnetic ions are communicating with each other within that lattice. And then if you take this to even higher phase, higher pressures, you get this sort of dull perovskite-like phase here where you have disorder on the sites here. So you have nickel antimony disorder. So just to show you some of the properties of these compounds. So the ambient pressure phase I mentioned orders at 13 Kelvin. So that's what you see in the susceptibility in red here. In blue is the susceptibility for the high pressure phase, the second high pressure phase where nickel spins are separated from each other. And even in the original compound here, even though it orders, there's a very high Curie-Weiss temperature of minus 170 Kelvin. So this principle is very frustrating. It's pressure index of around 9 or so. But nonetheless, it orders at 13 Kelvin. And if you measure the heat capacity, you find it's a nice T-cubed heat capacity, which indicates 3D antiferromagnetic spin excitations at a nice cusp at low temperatures. Now, the high pressure phase is different. The high pressure phase has a finite susceptibility. It's one of the same true as spin liquids. You'll probably hear more about that later this afternoon. And if you measure the heat capacity of this compound, you find it actually has a linear, an almost sort of linear component heat capacity. Remember, this is actually an insulating, electrical insulating compound here, so it shouldn't have a linear component heat capacity. So if you look at various theories in the literature, there are some kinetic physicists that are working on this that are suggesting this is due to one of these exotic spin-on excitations here, but we really can't explain this term. We don't know why it has this linear heat capacity low temperature. It was two-dimensionally expected to be T squared, but this is actually an increasing signature that we're seeing from more and more in spin liquid compounds, that they have this gamma T component. And the interpretation here is that these spin-ons form their own sort of Fermi surface, excitations form a Fermi surface themselves. Okay, so pressure is important. Pressure is an important way you can create new frustrated systems. In this case, it has a huge frustration index of over 217 and this anomalous behavior at low temperatures. So I mentioned, That's a great question. If you ask theoretical physicists to calculate it, they'll figure out a gamma T. But actually, there's no clear explanation for why it happens. The spin one half, you can imagine why it would happen, right? But in spin one, I can't imagine how it would happen. So this is truly anomalous. I don't know why you'd have that in a spin one system. Okay, so I mentioned power cores and with this high pressure theme. So I mentioned that we're recently working on new routes to new spin-ice compounds. So in the last talk you saw holmium titanate, dysprosium titanate, or sort of the canonical spin-ices. You can also create the standing compounds, a little messier because it's harder to grow standing crystals. But those four compounds are basically the only known spin-ices that are out there. So you need to have a delicate balancing of crystal field effects and exchange in order to create these systems. Recently, we looked at this power core stability map, and we noticed that there are these phases down here, these high-pressure phases of manganese and vanadium, which are stable under high pressure. And if you look at, if you put where the radius of germanium is, germanium is also a tetravalent non-magnetic ion, you also lie sort of very close to manganese here. So we tried making these compounds, and recently we succeeded in synthesizing both these members of the series, which are much, much smaller than holmium titanate and dysprosium titanate, so the magnetic exchange should be a lot greater. And you can see more about this in my talk tomorrow, and also Lana Hallis has a talk, or a poster on Tuesday if you want to learn more about this, just to whet your appetite a little bit. What happens in these compounds, this is a spin-ice phase diagram. So over here you have, this is elucidated by Den Hertog and Gingra about a decade ago, and what they've actually done is they've calculated where you should see a spin-ice relative to an antiferromagnetic phase based on your exchange. So if your exchange is mostly ferromagnetic, you get a spin-ice phase. If it's even slightly antiferromagnetic, you get a spin-ice phase because you have dipolar exchange which can overcome that. But if the dipolar exchange and J are roughly the same, you get a transition to an antiferromagnetic state. And what's nice about these germanium compounds is that the lattice is getting smaller and smaller. This is the X-ray diffraction of the 222 Bragg peak to show you that it's moving out to larger and larger 2 theta with respect to the standing and the titanate. So it's a much, much smaller lattice, and you can actually start to probe what happens as you get closer to this phase boundary. So these are only created under high pressure. You get like 50 milligrams at a time. We can't get sealed crystals yet. That's a very, very difficult synthesis. Okay, so speaking about crystal growth, so there's lots of methods to grow crystals. I'm going to focus mostly on image furnace growth because they've really changed kinetic matter physics, especially for neutron scattering, where you need large scale crystal of these compounds. Image furnaces are one of the only ways you can actually get crystals, you know, sort of the size of your finger, they can use for neutron scattering experiments. And the way it works is that you're using light to grow crystals, right? So you're using these lamps here to focus light down to a very narrow point inside the focus point of those mirrors. And that can get to roughly, well, get to over 2,000 degrees Celsius. But since that light is focused down to a very narrow point, even a few centimeters away, it's fairly cool. So you can put a camera there, and you can actually watch the crystal growth in real time. So that's a real advantage to using the image furnace as opposed to these aero techniques like flux growth and vapor transport and hydrothermal. But I will mention these before I go on and talk about image furnace growth. So first of all, flux growth. So it's a very traditional method. So it's use of a solvent to bring down temperature of your solute. And as temperature is lowered, eventually you get crystals that are formed, right? So you have to come up with some sort of material which uses your flux. You put everything inside of a container, including your starting materials for your compound. Heat up to high temperatures and then cool very slowly. You want your solvent to be liquid for a large part of your synthesis. And as you cool down, eventually you'll start getting these crystals that are forming inside your flux. By taking it down to room temperature, it'll be hard again, so you need to have something to dissolve that flux and get rid of it, and eventually you start picking your crystals out of that flux. So these are as an example of a growth we did on these chromates. These are actually spinel compounds. And showing you some of the parameters that we used. So we made zinc, nickel, and copper, chromium oxide, and we manganese as well. So you actually heat this up to high temperatures first to make the original compounds, and then you can start doing these flux growths. And the mass ratio is important, right? In this case, we used a bismuth oxide flux. You need to have a lot more solvent than what you actually have inside here, right? So you have to have a lot of excess of bismuth oxide. But we use this because you can dissolve it with nitric acid. So as you heat up to high temperatures, the solvent becomes liquid. And as you cool down at a very slow rate, it's just 2 degrees per hour, eventually you'll get crystals that form in there, and then you use nitric acid to clear out your sample and you get crystals out. Okay, so here's another method, an older method, but still used quite a bit for various compounds called vapor transport. So in vapor transport, what are you doing? You take a sealed tube and you put that tube in a temperature gradient, and you have your powder sample at one end, and what you want is your sand crystal to grow at the other end. So how does that work? Well, this is an example where you're growing magnetite. So magnetite is Fe3O4, which is the principle of frustrated structure. And in this case here, they're using hydrochloric acid gas as your transport. And this is a reaction that occurs at high temperatures. So you get FeCl2 gas, FeCl3 gas, and H2O gas. So these are all in the gas state. So this is an endothermic reaction. So remember your chemistry a little bit. As the temperature is increased, equilibrium gets shifted to the right. So if you have, if this is your hot end, this is your cold end, instead of 1270 Kelvin, this is 1000 Kelvin. At this end here, you'll have gas. Everything will go to the gas state. As it cools down, equilibrium shifts, and you'll get back towards the solid state. It goes back towards the left, right? So you have to know something about the reaction at high temperatures, and you have to do some work ahead of time before you try different types of growths, but this is a very common method that was used before for image furnaces came along. They're still being used by different groups, right? So the idea is you get crystals that grow at this end here, and then you cool everything down, break it open, and you try and scratch your crystals out rather than attach to the quartz. Okay, so hydrothermal growth. So hydrothermal methods are you're using pressures to grow crystals, right? So you're heating up the samples in a sealed tube with water. And under pressure, the water is superheated. So you can actually get it in a liquid phase above 100 degrees Celsius, and it'll stay liquid at high pressure, and then you can cool down slowly throughout that process. This is a natural process. A lot of crystals are grown this way, basically putting your materials inside of an autoclave and just superheating that water. Same thing that happens inside the earth for a lot of processes. So a lot of these minerals that you saw in Kerber Smithite have been grown by this method. This is showing you the schematic of how you would do this for quartz crystal growth or this yttrium-aluminum garnet crystal growth. Okay, so all these materials that you've seen that are perfect S1/2 materials, a lot of them are based on mineral structures, right? And because they're based on mineral structures, you can use these hydrothermal methods to grow these. This is the example of Herbert Smithite, and the MIT group has done a very good job optimizing the hydrothermal growths to make sure that they can get these nice crystals, and you can do all sorts of things like deuterate them, do NMR studies, all sorts of different things that you can do. Okay, so finally, image furnace growth. So this has had a huge impact in the field of kinetic matter science, and there's lots of these that are appearing all over the place in North America and around the world, and people are increasingly recognizing the importance of being able to use machines to grow high-quality steel crystals. In fact, these machines are responsible for A lot of the cuprates and superconductors are very sensitive to impurities. This is growing crystal essentially without a crucible, so you can't have those impurities from your crucible into your sample. Your polycrystalline rod is attached by a platinum wire, which you assume is inert, and then you're growing your crystal in the hot zone here. In the hot zone, you have a liquid here, and what you want to do is you want to have these rods that are rotating, so you promote mixing within a liquid zone, and then you're slowly translating the rod to try and get a crystal about the other end here. So you can go from fractions of a millimeter to an hour to millimeters per hour, but usually the slower growth results in better crystals. So they're very nice. I mean, a lot of people have bought these machines and started working on them. There's a lot of subtle chemistry that goes on at high temperature, so I want to discuss that to sort of close out my talk and summarize a little bit. Okay, so there's lots of parameters you can use for crystal growth, right? So you can have your lamp size, that controls the temperature as well as the size of your zone. You can put different gases in there depending on what sort of chemistry you're doing, if you're reducing or if you're oxidizing different things. You can control the speed. You can often pre-scan crystals, so you can have a polycrystalline rod you believe is quite unstable. You can put it through the zone at rapid speed and try to trap that thermodynamic phase in there, so you're not giving it time to oxidize or reduce, for example. For samples that have a lot of evaporation or are volatile, you can use a cold trap. So a cold trap is this device up here, which is at a much lower temperature than the rest of the furnace, and you have cold water rushing through here, so anything that's volatile will condense on top of that, and you can try to remove that from gunking up your furnace over time. For low melting point crystals, I'll give you some hints of how we made that lead Van-Dyke crystal. There's some things you can do with the image furnace to modify the temperatures. And solvents, right? You have to make sure that you have a congruently melting solid when you prepare these compounds. It means that it's all miscible at high temperatures. Okay, so this gives you a picture, an idea of the different types of zones you have. Just want to emphasize that for different types of lamps, you have different sizes of zones for your growth. And that's important, right? Depending on what sort of crystal you have, what sort of surface tension you have for liquid in there, the size of the zone matters, right? Size matters. So you have to worry about what happens when you go, even if you're going to higher temperatures. If your zone changes rapidly, you may have to worry about that with your crystal growth itself. And here's a close-up of that cold trap. You just have liquid going through here, which actually cools everything down and prevents volatile material from clouding up your quartz for your furnace itself. Okay, so just an example of some crystals that we've worked on or people have worked on over a number of years. So I mentioned the squirrel lattice and the principle of frustrates. Gives me an excuse to talk about cuprates a little bit. So this is lanthanum strontium copper oxide. And there are lots of people in the audience that are far more experts of this than I am. But if you're trying to grow different phases of these different crystals, the reason why I wanted to point this out is that in many cases, these sorts of phase diagrams aren't known for new samples, right? If someone like me is interested in making new samples, you have to figure out the phase diagram as you go along. But it turns out, for instance, there's a very well-known phase diagram. Depending on what sort of composition you want, you'll sit at some point in this phase diagram here, and you want to make sure you have some sort of immiscible liquid phase that's stable within the temperatures that you're doing your crystal growth. So this is an example where we're growing lanthanum strontium copper oxide. So in this case, we use a solvent ratio of 22 to 78. That was a solvent ratio of lanthanum strontium to copper oxide. We use a very slow growth rate here, and we use this temperature range here we saw here, which is roughly from 1100 to 1800 here to get about this liquid phase here. So you have to be careful for a lot of these growths. You know, you're fortunate if you have one of these phase diagrams to work on, but often you don't have these and you're working in the dark. So it's just trial and error trying to figure out what the phase diagram actually is for a lot of these compounds. And this is some of the crystals they can get out of it, and showing through Lowry photography, you get these nice ordered structures. This is strontium ruthenate, so it's another low-temperature superconductor. And there's this famous paper here by Zicheng Mao at Tulane, where he actually went through, and this isn't seen very often in literature, he actually went through very specifically how you can actually grow these samples. Crystal growers tend to keep their secrets to themselves, but he actually made this very nice paper where he showed what sort of ratios you need for strontium ruthenium oxide. One challenge of this sample here is that ruthenium oxide is very volatile, so you need to use a cold trap, and you need to use excess ruthenium oxide throughout your growth to make sure you get a stoichiometric ratio at the end. So this was actually the magic ratio here. So sample 89, you notice. So crystal growers are very patient people. So you can see this is a 1.15 ratio of two ruthenium over strontium here for your stoichiometry and the various growth conditions that he used to actually get this sample to have the highest TC, which was 1.5. And now when I first got my, I used to be at the magnet lab, I just got my crystal furnace in the magnet lab, I want to see what we could do with it, sort of test drive. We actually went to literature and found his paper and see if we can grow the crystal, and we did. So we actually had crystal which had a pretty high transition temperature. So finally, more frustrate systems. I have a couple slides left, Bruce. So this is actually looking at pyrochlores. So terbium titanate and ytterbium titanate that have been grown through the image furnace. Power cores grow very well in any systems here. They're nice cubic systems, but you have to be careful with power cores in the image furnaces, right? So you notice here in the ytterbium sample, for example, there are these color variations throughout the crystal, right? So that's telling you something. It's telling you that there's defects within here, right? And oxygen stoichiometry is something you really have to worry about in these samples here. And we believe that a lot of these defects here are they could be due to crystal defects themselves, but also due to oxygen stoichiometry throughout that growth. Okay, so here's lead-vanadium oxide I mentioned right at the beginning. So how do we grow this sample? Well, it's a terrible sample to deal with the chemistry of this. So it actually melts at very low temperatures and becomes volatile. So what we did is in the image furnace, we actually masked the lamps. It's actually using tin foil here to mask the lamps. So why are we doing this? Well, when we turn on the image furnace, you can't see anything actually until you get to around 1100 or 1200 degrees, right? In this case, you have to worry about growing this at low temperatures. So by the time you actually start seeing your sample, it's volatile and you're losing it, right? Just because of the optics of the system itself. So we use these actually to lower the temperature of the image furnace so we can actually start seeing the crystal growth. So we actually did a low temperature growth between 700 and 900 degrees in order to get this sample. And we did a pre-scan at first, since it was very unstable. We made a very thin rod, and then we did a pre-scan burst to try to trap that phase in there. And then we did a slower scan later, and we got this nice sealed crystal of this one-dimensional chain compound. Okay, and finally, I just want to mention that crystal chemistry can get pretty complicated. These vanadium spinels, we're looking at orbitally ordered phases for these spin 1/2 compounds. And there's all sorts of different types of growth conditions that you need. So you can be fooled a little bit by looking at the periodic table, looking at different compounds and saying, oh, I can make this sample because I know how to make this sample where I change one ion. Depending on what ions you have in there, the chemistry becomes very different at high temperature. So in this case here, you can see these growths are actually fairly simple. We pre-made them with argon, and you can fire them in the image furnace. But down here for magnesium and for cobalt, you have to worry about some other conditions here. So magnesium is a very small ion. It tends to come out, so you have to add extra magnesium oxide to compensate for that. In this case here, for cobalt vanadium oxide, cobalt is a terrible deal, so is vanadium in the image furnace, and you have to worry about V2O3 coming out. So this can get rapidly complicated, and this is sort of a cautionary tale. If you get into image furnace growth or crystal chemistry in general, you can't just look at the periodic table and say, well, substitute this for this, because there's all sorts of conditions you might not be aware of during that crystal growth. And you often have to rely on your intuition. So in that case, it's more like an art than a science. So with that, I'd like to that picture of our crystals that we grew. So with that, I'd like to just sum up and say that my group is actually a neutron scattering group. We want to eventually do neutron scattering experiments in USR and work in high fields. But we spend most of our time down here. I spend most of our time in crystal growth. And it's you have to be very patient if you want to live in this world. But I think it's also very rewarding because you get these beautiful samples, and you often are the first people to see the properties of these different samples that you create. So with that, I'd like to thank you for your attention. The original paper was a subramanian paper, I think. But you can look up that GG review article, also have a link to it. But subramanian paper.
Further questions? Or yes, please, Philip.
I mentioned the photon.
Well, you have to, Bruce knows more than I do, Barley, but you have to fire under different conditions, under oxygen. The question was, how do you control oxygen stoichiometry and power chlorides is a great question. It's something that's plagued the community for a long time. So you're changing oxidation states on different ions if you don't have oxygen stoichiometry. You have to be careful. You have to do TGAs in your samples. You have to measure the magnetic properties. You have to measure a lattice constant compared to people have done. You have to measure the susceptibility and make sure you have the right moment. But it's a complicated question. And I think I think there's always some oxygen non-stoichiometry, especially on the surface, but something that's difficult to control in these crystals. Often, when you get a crystal like this, you're cutting up that crystal and using only a certain part of it that you know is the right color in the beginning, and then you're doing TGA work on that and the susceptibility and so on afterwards. They're powder samples. It's an enamel press, yeah. So you take a metal foil and you put your starting stoichiometric quantities of your sample in there, and you press your metal foil, and you put it inside of a high-pressure furnace, and then you peel it out, and you look for the black bits out of the white bits, and you get milligrams per growth.